So we're working our way through the Joyous Sacrifice by E.J. Gold, and tonight we're on sacrifice number 4, and it's entitled The Sacrifice of Ordinary Life, Life of the Unclean. Before we do that, there are two things I'd like to read. First one is actually an interesting riddle that I've read sometimes the last 2 or 3 years on my online class. The passions of delusion are inexhaustible. I vow to extinguish them all at once. The number of beings is endless. I vow to give them all. The truth cannot be told. The way which cannot be followed is unattainable. That's for the class in general to get a set. Here is for the class. Single greatest technique to work on self. Manifestations of others without resentment, oppression, displeasure, or the demand for intelligence, reason, justice, or conscience on the part of others. Endure silently and cheerfully, and suffer in this epoch. That's our setting for this, what I consider a very, very, very unusual class to see. I've got a couple of emails from individuals that have written in and posted on the website. The website is wingsofchaos.com/joyoussacrifice. And you'll see some comments there. And it's helpful both to those who have the courage to post and others coming along. Post comments. We'll get to those in a little bit. Parts of this particular chapter. I'm going to read a part, stop. We're going to discuss it for a moment, and then we're going to read the second part. There's two functionally different parts to this chapter. So, title of the chapter, sacrifice number 4, it's The Sacrifice of Ordinary Life, and it's called Life of the Unclean. Opening paragraph. One sacrifices ordinary life only to return to it after having become changed. But although one returns to it, one sacrifices ordinary life forever. Because having become changed, one has transcended everything which makes the world powerful. One can say that the world no longer has a state over one's nature. It loses its powers of fascination. So, that's the opening paragraph of the chapter called Sacrifice of Ordinary Life. What is the author trying to tell us there? Tossing the ball in the air. The volleyball is tossed in the air, ready to be spiked by someone. Ivan, are you that someone? Let me read a couple sentences again. One sacrifices ordinary life only to return to it after having become changed. One can say that the world no longer has authority over one.
The word that struck me at the end of that passage was that word fascination.
It loses the world, it loses powers of fascination. Loses its powers of fascination. So what's occurred here, what has occurred, is that we stand in the ordinary world. We come back to the ordinary world, right? Because this path that we're on is we're in the world. We're working in the world. We're not in the master. We're in the world. How then, what could it mean to come back to it? Change. What is change? Such that the fascinations of the world no longer hold sway over us. Something's changed.
David?
Yeah.
This is Eric.
Hi, Eric.
Hi. Could it be that we're no longer invested in the world the same way afterwards? We're no longer invested in what people think about us?
What do you mean?
Or,
what do you mean by the word afterwards?
After having willingly or not undergone an experience in which you can't care about what people think and remain connected, because you're talking about the experience of having been unseen.
Okay, so the title is Life of the Unclean. Okay, so Eric's giving us a hint, but I'm not going to take that hint up quite yet, so I'm going to plow on. Eric, hold that thought.
Okay.
Very good, very important. So then, suddenly, the chapter changes. The whole paragraph does not continue with that discussion. To sacrifice one's ordinary life, because, let me back up a minute. My objective in doing this, in doing HVM, practical work on self, and now this, is to find pragmatic answers to how, therefore, do you perform something as lofty as a sacrifice? What do you do to get yourself in a position that a sacrifice can actually take place? That's what we're talking about, okay? Practical methods. And I believe that with intention, we can find those in each one of these sacrifices. I'm going to be, next time I'll review where we are so far. We actually have a load of very important possibilities. So, it continues. Life of the unclean. What could that mean? Here it is. To sacrifice one's ordinary life, one must dress badly, even stupidly, and keep a slovenly yet clean appearance. One wears torn clothes, walks shuffle, appears to be an incompetent. Even dangerous. But while one seems stupid to others, one performs all tasks with attention, powerful intention, and remember oneself, one's aim. To work on oneself, attach that idea to all manifestations, to suggestions, and in short, one becomes unclean, only in appearance, but not in one's inner life or duties to the community of work. Now, this next part is something that is very, very, very difficult to do. If you're not in community, and what we're trying to do is create ways and means for those who aren't physically living in community or ashram life with others. We're trying to find out how can we perform some of these things. Maybe we're the only person in our area that's working in this manner. But listen carefully. One is restricted from attending all sacred observations and obligatories. One may not read, study, or discuss the sacred scriptures or efforts for work with others. One is isolated from the work community and treated as if unclean. One is not permitted to perform household tasks or temple duties, either for work community or for an outside community. One becomes a complete outsider. One may not eat at the table with others, walk into or through the kitchen area, dining area, or temple, handle food or eating utensils used by others, clean eating areas or walk through places used for the carrying on of work or assimilating or studying. One may not handle food substances used by others or make offerings of any kind during or between obligatory. One must, in fact, be literally spoon-fed by another who is now in the stage of service, so that utensil will not be touched by one's hand. One may only be addressed by one's teacher or by one's server during this stage. Even the coach or assistant to the teacher are forbidden to communicate with one who is unclean. Imagine, and we can do that, imagine yourself being put in such a situation where you are in a situation where in your community, let's say your community consists of your family. And we have this in little ways. Let's say you do live in a family house, and there's you and your the three children. What if somebody is very ill? Let's say they have a bad flu. It would be wise for that person not to be allowed to go into the kitchen, right? Make sense?
Yeah, that would be a form of unclean.
That'd be a form of unclean that we're talking about. So if you did that with that person, after a while that person will start feeling that sense of being shunned, right? Even though there's just an objective thing. Well, of course they shouldn't be cooking or using the utensils of others. Makes sense. But you start to feel that sense of being shunned anyway. And especially if someone says, oh, no, honey, don't touch that. You're sick. Right? What does that call for? What happens when that's going on in us? And that's where I'm trying to get to with Eric is telling us. After something, and then what is that something? And more importantly, what occurs during that? What occurs during that event?
David. Hello?
Yes, Simon, go ahead.
Sorry, greetings, Ivan and David. Sorry, I just made it in. I hear quite often that the word shun that you were mentioning, and it keeps ringing in my head, how you are displaced, that you are somehow ostracized of the group that you identify so much. And at the moment, I cannot have a particular example on that, but I do have the example when we were childs or youngsters, you know, like adolescents.
Yeah.
And when you're in a school, that in that particular time of your life, your peers are so important, and you are being left on the side because perhaps you don't have the skills to perform like the group, or you don't have the looks to belong to a group, and they automatically put you on the side.
Right.
That, and I remember, and I have seen it too, that immense sense of that how worthless you were because you were being shunned. They decide to take you out. So the closest feeling that I have to that to that situation is that emotion that I remember from childhood, perhaps, when you have been displaced out of the group by their own decision. How I felt.
What is that emotion?
Well, it, a few things. You feel shame. You feel like you are not accepted in the group, that you are not to the call for the people that you appreciate and you would like to be. So it got different colors, different emotions. I repeat, you get shame, you feel frustration, you get not being accepted.
It's deeper than nothing. Repeat, you just said something about what is it that you feel about the group that you want to be in? What did you say about that?
Well, that in that moment of your life, at least in that moment of my life, in that moment, it was very important for me, the group, my peers. It had a great importance that I had been, that I could be accepted.
Accepted by
so the moment that they don't, I don't have what they are looking for, they shun you.
Yeah, I have a question for you. Would you say, in retrospect, I mean, I can I can easily relate to what you're talking about from childhood and school and so on, right?
Yeah, I have.
Would you say that you were identified with that group?
Well, obviously, in that time, yes. In that time was very important to me because I liked the group, because I liked the people, and definitely I was identified. So one thing as well that it gave the power, I mean, it's so powerful that because you're identified with the group. If you're not identified with the group, you couldn't care less what they do. But you are identified.
So I'm remembering that I wanted to be, if I felt shunned or I felt like an outsider, it's because I wanted to be in the in crowd. You know, I wanted to be part of that group, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that in this text that David has just read, that this is an aspect of the fascination very much being identified with a persona, with my persona, and being part of a group of people and so on. This exercise or this sacrifice here is asking me to, well, actually I'm not too, I have to go back and look at it. It's either asking me to simulate, you see, that I don't have that fascination or identification with the group. And in fact, this chapter is referring to me that being my group that I'm working with on the spiritual path is the group that I'm now going to disidentify with and become the outsider from.
Ivan, I totally agree with you. The only thing I'm sharing this with you, because today I don't have any group to identify with. But the only thing I can relate to is that moment in my past when I was identified and how I felt.
Hold on, Simon. What I was just hitting upon, I think you do have a group to identify with, and I think I do now, too. In other words, a good question to ask might be, have a stage behind where we're able to be so disidentified with a group that we don't have this feeling of being an outsider.
Sorry, could you repeat that again?
What Ivan is telling us is there's part of him that still has that same desire to be included. And so what is the exercise here? What is the effort that we can make to achieve something here? It's called the life of the unclean. And there's two. This is not a psychological drama.
Right. That's
this
important.
This is not.
Yeah.
To put yourself so you can go, oh, cool. Here's the psychology that I had, and then we can chat about it. Okay. I'm going to take a minute while we think about that. I'm going to read what Susan had to write on the website. I didn't mean to do it when I set out today, but after I went to the physical therapy for a back issue, I was starving. I wouldn't normally get food out, but was in need. I went to a sandwich shop, but I only had $5. When I asked the guy what I could get, he said, well, there'll be tax, and I could only get a few limited things. Not really what... He immediately dismissed me and started to go to the next person. Realizing that I did have a bunch of change, I decided to upgrade to something more edible. The guy seemed put out, but started my sentence. The interesting thing was the cashier. I put down my $5 and started to count out a pile of change. She went out of her way to try to make me feel okay about not having more money, even making jokes. I'm sure I looked frightful. Hair a mess with a look of pain left on my face from my doctor, on my face from my doctor's visit. Then, for added fun, not planned, only because I didn't think of it, I dropped several pennies. The customer behind me was happy to help and pick them up, but the lady behind him was glaring at the whole change thing. I was not surprised by being shunned, but I hadn't counted on was a couple of people that tried extra hard to be nice and helpful. So, what happened there? This time, Susan, are you on the line? What happened here is that Susan didn't mean to do this.
Right.
She got caught up in a circumstance.
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Susan.
She is there.
Greetings.
Hi.
Found herself in this circumstance. Now, what I ask is, there was this, when you were feeling this, if I may ask you to dig, let's just dig a little deeper for a moment, okay?
Okay.
And so the individual, he immediately dismissed me. So think back on that moment when this guy marginalized you because you didn't have the right ticket, you didn't have enough money.
Right.
He just dismissed you right then, right?
Yes.
So describe as well as you can what was going on in you.
Well, I guess some of it was frustration at not being able to get what I wanted. There was, I guess, a feeling of, wait, don't I count too?
Okay.
And then there was also the how quickly he gave up and was just kind of like, okay, go away.
Hey, don't I count too?
Right.
Well, what do you mean?
I guess it's a feeling of not being accepted.
He dismissed me. He immediately dismissed me. You weren't accepted. You were cast out.
Yes.
You were cast out as unclean and just boom, she's gone. She's not in this crowd of the regular people that should be, they should know what they're doing when they come in here. They should know better, right?
Right, oh yeah. He was real annoyed that I didn't have the answer for him right then.
You didn't have the answer, you made it difficult. Who are you?
Right.
Now, where is the prize in this sacrifice? That's what I say. Where is the prize? The prize is consciously holding ourselves in that particular moment. Simon, we can theoretically realize the fact that we remembered that when we were in high school or childhood, so on and so forth, but go out and do this tomorrow. And that's why, what are the ways and means we can come up with whereby we can put ourselves in that position.
Well, I sure wish I had dropped a lot more change.
There you go.
Why, you were trying to be a bag lady?
Well, I didn't do it on purpose, but it was really fun to watch.
Yeah, I see.
And it's fun to watch yourself. Now, there's something golden that you get. If you can hold yourself in that position, there's something behind it, and there's a reason why this is a time-tested sacrifice. We say, oh, this is just, this is something that you can only do if you're in a work community. Well, look at, what if you dressed up and you wore black pants, you had a black shirt, a black jacket, let's say, and a very high collar that covered everything except for a little white section that stuck out here. And you went out into the world that way.
You mean a clerical collar? Doesn't that sound like you were describing a clerical collar? That's not what you meant, I guess.
Yes, it is.
It is what he meant. Okay.
So you would be, what would happen if you dressed up, let's say you wore a very, very long dress with very long, it was black, but heavy material, and the arms went down, you covered all your skin except for your hands, very high collar, your hair was totally covered, and you went out into public in that way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They might ask you to pray for them and their cat.
Say Hail Mary.
Yeah.
Yeah. That reminds me, what I see in this sacrifice, exactly as you're describing, is that we are having a grip here in one of the stronger features of the false personality, which is self-image, valuation, and all, how much are you worth it, or the contrary, how much you are diminished by people. So that cancels the offense, you feel offended, you feel diminished, you feel not included. Am I right?
Okay. Yeah, is that the experience we're talking
about?
Well,
that's the psychology behind it.
Okay, well, can I raise a question?
Please do.
See, I'm recalling this exercise called the red-faced donkey, okay? I feel like if Susan went out deliberately to find an opportunity to have this experience, to cultivate this feeling of being out of step and being, acting out of the pattern or not mechanically enough for other people, let's say. I think because it's among strangers and it's supposed to be something not dangerous to you or to them, it strikes me as being like the red-faced donkey. Okay, the question I have is whether there's a specific issue that's being proposed.
That was a glitch in the film.
Yeah,
that.
Right. What was it? Peripheral value? Something in peripheral vision. This form of outsideness, of being the outsider.
Being
here,
the outsider.
It's saying, this sacrifice is saying to be the outsider and unclean, more like with your family, like you were saying, with the people that you, not strangers, it's the people that you actually have a tree de core with, that you're collaborating with, people that are your set, that you're, so, it seems to me that this other issue that we talked about, like the fascination of ordinary life or the identification with, like I want to be cool by being identified with this group of people. I mean, is there still this element, let's say even for this, our Wednesday night group here, is it cool for us to be identified, to be part of this discussion group here? I'm just thinking that it's different to like embarrass yourself or to do something, to step out of the box with strangers than as opposed to this. I'm just getting at something where this jump that you mentioned, you see, from the idea of the having leaving, it's like without leaving ordinary life, and coming back to it because there's a change. The change is that there's now not that identification. There's the fascination that you have experienced as ordinary life or in ordinary life. You've
blown away.
You've diminished. You've at least diminished it.
You've started to realize the concept, I am not that.
Yeah, okay.
I am not that.
So it seems to me there's a very strong hint in there. There's a strong indicator that you're that person who's the outsider is now doing, you know, the appearance is altered, the behavior is altered. The person is not part of the ordinary work schedule or work pattern or work community or work collaboration, let's say teamwork. That person is excluded specifically from teamwork. But everything that person does is still done with an eye to work on self and with high attention and
high
concentration.
Intention, yes.
Yeah. But it's not. But the element that's not there is that, oh, I'm part of a work group. I'm part of a. Yeah. You're specifically not part of a collaborative group.
You're not Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying. To me, the key element is recognition is what's missing. You're not getting recognition. It's not. To me, it's not even necessarily inclusion as such as, but recognition.
Yeah,
it's
there you
not
go.
The social, in a work community, there is a social element also. We have a social element in our work community here. No question about it.
Right.
And to be separated from that social element is no different than trying to be accepted in the in-group in high school. Same thing.
Hey, Dave, I'd like to throw in a couple of pennies.
Please.
If we go back to human biological machine in which we are informed that our essence is submerged in the dominant electrical force of our physical body and historical personality, the challenge posed to us in human biological machine is can you separate these two parts of ourselves and allow the essence to grow in such a way that it can awaken the human biological machine. And that's what Book of Sacrifices is. It's a way of speaking directly to the essence and informing it what things it might consider doing in order to lessen that dominating force of the historical personality. In the chapter just before this, The Sacrifice of Habits, we're informed that as the essence develops, it eats the psyche little by little, just as the yolk of the egg depends upon the albumen. Thus, the psyche is not destroyed utterly. Its hold over the essence is broken, and its domination of the organism is finished. And then, logically and consistently, we come into the next chapter, The Sacrifice of Ordinary Life, again, speaking to the essence, saying, look it, try to separate yourself from the feeling of superiority that you normally feel in the course of your ordinary life. In other words, I don't necessarily read this chapter literally, dress down, but that the essence should be cognizant of not suppressing, but diminishing the dominance of that historical personality.
Okay.
The unclean.
Thank you for that. That's exactly the point. Now, Susan, during the moment when Susan was held in a period of time here where her psychology, which is the historical personality, was probably desperately trying to get out of that pain, the pain of discomfort, right? We understand that she's embarrassed. We can chuckle about being embarrassed and so on. But Susan, let me ask you, you couldn't get out of that moment, right? She was locked into that embarrassment for a period of time from initiating the sandwich to getting the sandwich. She was locked into it. She couldn't escape.
Well, and if the only other way to escape would have been to break would be to walk out.
Right.
Well, yes, we knew you could do that, but you didn't. Now, so you were held in that moment where the normal acceptances and as excuse me for being direct, but your ego wasn't allowed to freely dominate during that moment because you didn't have the money. You couldn't pay the ticket. Now, during that period of time, did you notice anything else? Was the pressure, the ego, the pressure being... Yes, you noticed the helpful people?
Well, I mean, there was a physical sensation standing there. The feeling of, where do I go? How do I decide? He's waiting. So the physical, you know, all across the shoulders, kind of a pressure.
Yeah. You couldn't escape either, could you?
No, it's like you're squirming. Where do I turn?
But you couldn't escape.
Correct.
And holding yourself in that position, so I maintain that there was another process starting to emerge right then, and this is what I'm hoping we can discover for ourselves, that at that moment, the historical personality, the machine, there was no possible way to find refuge there. You could not find refuge in the machine.
Right.
And suddenly, the principle called, I am not that, was at work. Because you were still there. You as an essential self were still there. And that heat of the moment, that heat, as we read in that one quote, that the alchemical heat of holding ourselves there in that position is literally a moment of transformation. That's right behind this element of being shunned. And that's why I say, Simon, that this is not a psychological effort. This isn't something where we're trying to get into interesting and exciting psychological conundrum. I'm going to expand the example. Now I'm going to read Eric's offering. Eric, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. This is very, I'm just going to read it. This didn't occur to me when I read the chapter. But reading your question, David, I have an answer. I underwent a social, legal, gender change. In order to go through with it, I had to let go of my concerns about my status. And indeed, as it turned out, was shunned by much of my family. I remain a person of secondary status in that manner. Another facet of the experience is that whereas I went into it with a strong desire to be recognized for who and what I am, I came out of it with the same knowledge that because language does not exist and does not for anyone, recognition of that sort is not possible. I can't tell the truth about myself no matter how hard I try. All concepts distort and mask reality. Our ideas, if held fast, make it impossible to see what is before us. I have learned that I am powerless to control other people's judgments, assumptions, perceptions, which are many and contradictory. So I have stopped trying and simply except that I am a visitor in a strange land, as are we all. So Eric has put himself in a position that's diametrically opposed to many, many, many norms of society, where he is rejected. He cannot be accepted. by many groups, by certain groups. And there's this feeling of constantly being shunned. But he has left ordinary life and gone and tacked his boat a different way. And is sailing on a different path at this point. There's a whole group of people that have put themselves in that position. People like the Hasidic Jews, Jewish community in general, but certainly the conservative or the Hasids themselves. They live life determined to be devout and follow the commandments. They are sons. But if all we do is look for a different ego with which to find our way back out of that, we have gained what is possible out of this sacrifice. What's possible is in that moment of being shunned to observe what I call that alchemical fire of clarity. And it's a clarity of the essential self. It has, you have nowhere to stand. And Susan, this is what I think was also behind it for you. You have nowhere to stand psychologically or socially other than in yourself. It's a moment of freedom.
There you go. There's a good idea. That's what I'm tending towards, what Silverdale was saying about this, you know, that there's a core idea of how to work from essence. How to do tasks, daily tasks, concentrating, you know, on the idea that it's a work task, or that one is working on oneself, dividing attention and so on while doing this task. And that's, again, taking the attention, the identification,
now,
the absorption away from the machine.
Away from the machine.
Machine life.
The machine is just
the
in that psychology.
The personality or machine aspect of that ordinary life.
Now, Susan. So if now Susan decides to go to a different sandwich shop, and she goes in there with only $4 and a giant pile of pennies and quarters, she's in a sense going back to ordinary life, right? Or even if she did go back to that same sandwich shop for some reason, and she went in there, she'd be going back to ordinary life, but with a different set of tools.
Think about this one.
Okay. Do you understand, Susan? Does it make sense what I'm asking?
It does, but I would need to identify the tools a little clearer.
Okay, the tools are your essential self. And we have to practice these things. We have to practice having a sensation of what our essential self is. We have to have a sense of when we are standing in that. It has a different signature, has a different heat element to it. It really does feel different.
Well, I think that today's... Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Well, because I had already read this sacrifice, and I was already in that looking at it, so when it happened, I wasn't taken so off guard. I kind of was able to watch it.
Good. Yeah.
So, I mean, I didn't suffer as much, or I didn't get as identified as I could have.
Correct. And you had enough wherewithal that you were actually reporting it. For many people, it was just, oh, that was a lousy sandwich shop. I'm never going back there again. we're talking about the dynamics of inner work here and finding a different place to stand. One example, and so finding ways and means to do this, guys, that's what we're trying to do. Placing ourselves consciously in these types of circumstances. I gave an example like going to a market that is very, very, you know, very busy, a lot of people, long lines, and you have a basket, huge basket full of things, and finally you get to the checkout scanner, and you, and the person, and you say, gosh, I don't have enough money for that. Can you take a few things out? And, you know, there's 10 people behind you in line glaring at you. The person is desperately trying to get you out of the store. Can you stand and observe? That moment, you have no standing in ordinary life. And that's true in legal sense, too. You have no standing.
Somehow, David and Ivan, it reminds me, and this is really much an extreme, but one of the last tasks that Carlos Castaneda was given by the Mujer Nahual, the Nahual woman, after Carlos had been very successful with books and he was really a personality by himself, he says, you are going to make your living now in the last job that you can find. And he find him a job in a highway frying burgers. And she said to him, you are going to stay in that job until you wouldn't mind to spend the rest of your life doing that. And for me, that is what that is the key thing that you somehow you are saying is
yeah.
that you got to stay there. You don't have to run away from it. You got to observe it. And you got to accept it. I remember because if you don't accept it, if you don't stay there with it, you're the only thing that you are doing is just having tolerance or patience. And this brings
well,
me some things that EJ said, that there is a difference between tolerance and acceptance. Tolerance is never enough.
That's right.
So acceptance...
We're not trying to grit our teeth with a bigger, different ego and just stand it. We're actually trying to embrace the reality of where we are at that moment. And embrace the fact that I don't have money right now. I don't have that. That's the truth. Even though you are shunned by that little society that formed around Susan today, the truth is I don't have that money. And in a societal way, that's the truth of who I am right then. That's the truth. But you to embrace it fully, I am a short order cook. That is what I am doing. Until you see that the I that you're speaking about it supersedes all of that. And we have so there is a true prize to win. If we can put ourselves in such a situation, and we may not have the wherewithal or the will to do that. If we don't have the will to do it, then wait for the moment when it'll occur, when you drop your purse. And don't just pick up your purse and be done with it and be embarrassed. Watch yourself. What's it like? What if you don't have the correct change for the bus? Hold, notice what happens, and then come back and read the first paragraph of this chapter, which I'm going to do right now. One sacrifices ordinary life. One sacrifices ordinary life only to return to it after having become changed. But although one returns to it, one sacrifices ordinary life forever. Because having become changed, one has transcended everything that makes the world powerful. One can say that the world no longer has authority over one's essence nature. It loses its power of fascination. So, Susan, if you were thrust in that situation again, would you be entering ordinary life in the same way? You might not.
Might not. I don't know if you could recreate. I mean, you wouldn't try to recreate the same thing.
Right. Right. Yeah, we wouldn't.
But it would be coming in with some distance. Coming in not as identified with it.
And even if you went back to that same very sandwich shop, you would be different in it. You would have been strengthened because there was 1 ounce, one little teeny ounce of essential self that was grown at that moment. And that, in my opinion, is never taken from us.
Well. So, yeah, it sometimes doesn't get better than well.
Yep, that's right. And when what happens and what this first paragraph is talking about is that we are in ordinary life. We are attached to ordinary life. And if we find actual ways and means, not just the mental mentation about it, but actual ways and means to chisel our way out of it. There are a number of techniques, but in many ways, and this is one, to sacrifice ordinary life, life of the unclean. As soon as you start to do something different than everybody else, you are assumed, you are treated as you are unclean.
David.
Yes.
David, Ivan, I don't know if you can hear me right. This is Coyote.
Coyote, greetings.
Hello. Excellent, excellent discussion. I wanted to point something out about this particular technique and the mechanism that makes it possible. You see, when we learn to build a personality around the essence, most of it was built for the purpose of defending something that the essence was feeling, that the essence was afraid of losing. When we built this strategy, it was built around this world that we were encountering at the moment. And so at one moment, we felt shame, ridicule, vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that thing that feels vulnerable wants to be protected. And we created the personality, or just the simple strategies of how we look at people, how we move, how we talk. Most of that has been designed to keep us safe in that sense. This chapter, this sacrifice of ordinary life, is bringing us back to that moment.
Yes.
Moment when, and that is why that feeling of shame, of vulnerability, of being the center of ridicule or what have you, that's why that sensation is indeed the essence.
Behind it, right behind it is the essence, because that's the only other place to go at that point. Let's say that you had an auto accident, and it was super serious, but you got into an auto accident. At the moment that occurred, there's this feeling of ridicule and vulnerability that occurs. Or let's say you're trying to buy a trailer and you're not sure and you don't know if it's the right one. You don't know it's going to fit. At that moment, you are exposed. So how can we put ourselves in a position to allow ourselves to be exposed? The key here, though, is not just to go into psychology of shame and sit and quickly the ego tries to rebuild. Sit with that shame and let it burn in us in a certain way. So, there you
go. But David.
Yes.
David, question. Isn't it what always we do that? We may not have... Remember, we have been in situations like that. What else happens? We have felt totally overwhelmed by the shame, and there's nothing you can do. Except the only thing you can do is maybe have to excuse yourself or start finding stories. But pretty much what we have done is to endure it, because you cannot judge it.
You can observe what's going on in you.
That's it. That's it, because that's the moment of an awakened state of the machine.
There you go.
I have a feeling for what Coyote is talking about. There's certain moments that are very, very memorable for myself. They're memorable, Simon, for this exact reason that you're talking about, is it was a completely inescapable, a no exit.
That's it.
Experience, a no-exit situation. But being able to observe that, having the detachment, or let's say for me now, having the memory of having observed that, is to say, oh, okay, that force of that extreme agony and shame of being trapped like that is only the essence that involuntarily, that unnaturally or unwishingly created that personality, has that pain. There's pain. I'm not sure.
There is also the fact that you take this on voluntarily.
There you go.
And that makes you able to detach yourself in order to observe more fully. Become a fool on purpose.
That's the point. Because if you place yourself in that foolish position, the machine will react with shame. It will start happening. And involuntarily, if you hold yourself there, the essential self starts to emerge. And it starts, you can begin to see it. But it's that little flame that is of great interest to me. And it's only done if we can place ourselves in those positions. Fortunately for most of us, we're clumsy, we're not very smart, and we find ourselves in these positions all the time. So,
yes.
Our own life provides it almost daily. The key is, try not to escape from it right away. Let it burn for just a moment. Let yourself be what the machine, in a sense, has given you. That's the prize. Harvest what's below it. Okay?
That's how I choose my students.
Yeah. You've chosen quite a group.
Everybody's getting wasted now.
We're almost at the end of our time here, and I just want to thank everybody for coming, and we'll continue next week, but Sinhog has posed a question to us. Who are all the teachers that are depicted at the beginning of each chapter? And looks like he's got a portion of them, but not all of them. So maybe what we can do is maybe I'll list out who they are as well as we could get to them.
Okay.
He has Ramakrishna as one, no answer for two. Three, John Lilly. Four is Ram Dass. Seven, Pure Vilayat. Eight, Free John. Nine, Samuel Avital. Ten, Tim Leary. 11, Lee Loswick. 13 is Swami Prabhupada. 15 is Lahiri Mahashaya. And 18 is Guru Jeff. That's all we have at the moment, but maybe I can write the names.
Did he say 11 is Lee Loswick?
Yeah.
Okay.
We don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
But we won't get off on that at
okay.
the moment, because
right.
we want to keep this mood going. But if you know one of them, then you can write it in to me or post it. I'm going to go ahead and start posting those on some of the chapters. But recall the use of this chapter and the ways and means that we can bring it to ourselves here, okay? The ways and means are important. That's what we're trying to develop for ourselves and for others. Next week, we'll meet again at 7 o'clock on Wednesday. We're going to work with sacrifice number 5, which is the sacrifice of tendencies, life of the truth. So thank you for coming again, and I look forward to seeing everybody next week.
Thank you, David and Ivan.
Thanks. Thanks, David. Thank you, Coyote, for showing up tonight.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Coyote. Goodbye. Bye, Eric.
Goodbye, brothers and sisters. Bye-bye.